Hello, and welcome to the Harrisonburg 360 podcast. I'm your host, Hannah Nick. I'm so excited to be here and have you listen to our podcast. The Harrisonburg 360 podcast is an attempt to capture and record narratives of immigrants living in the Harrisonburg community. Using past and present voices of Harrisonburg immigrants, students in our JMU English class have collaborated to create a space focused on the importance of listening to each other's voices. Every person deserves a chance to share their story, and we, as a class, are privileged to share these stories with you in hopes of expanding perceptions of what it means to be an immigrant in Harrisonburg. Each week, Harrisonburg 360 is produced by a different team of students. This week's episode, Lost in Translation, was produced by Emily Kilman, Hannah Nick, Charlotte Lawrence Hovey, and Elena Sanders. Last week's episode, Mixed, discussed growing up as a mixed-race child of immigrants. In this week's episode, we'll specifically discuss barriers in communication. We talk about children of immigrants who act as translators for their parents in a wide variety of situations. From appointments at the doctor's office and banks, these children are given the responsibility to accurately translate between two languages. Oftentimes, these children are translating concepts that they do not even understand themselves. We will also discuss the reaction of other children to immigrants within their communities who are not always accepting of them. Connections on both of these subjects will be drawn between our literary discussion and our interview with our narrator, Jaime. Our interview with Jaime Cañas starts out with him giving background information on how he and his family came to the United States. At 3 years old, following an earthquake, his family immigrated to Charlottesville, Virginia, under Temporary Protected Status, or TPS. As a child, Jaime recalls having to assist in translating for his parents and how there was frustration when something cannot be translated correctly or emotion cannot be conveyed accurately. Moving to the present, Jaime describes his community as those who have had a positive impact on his life, such as his family and close friends. He and his wife often go to his parents' house, and he does fun activities with his friends fairly often. Jaime also described the immigration process as teaching him independence from an early age, which also affected his education. When it came to applying to college, he found out he could not receive financial aid due to his immigrant status and had to pay for school all on his own. With help from close family friends, he was able to get co-signers for loans, who also became his co-sponsors during his green card process. Jaime says that as a child, he would get teased for being Mexican, but learned to ignore them if they proved themselves to be ignorant. The interview ends with Jaime talking about his degree in psychology, which was a huge goal for not only himself, but also his dad. He hopes to go back to school someday and get his master's as well. We are briefly going to talk about some literary pieces that we saw had some connections to our interview with Jaime. These pieces include Translation as an Arithmetic of Loss by Ingrid Rojas Contreras, The Ungrateful Refugee by Dina Nayari, and Community Support for Migrants Navigating the U.S. Immigration System from the American Immigration Council website. So the first piece we were going to talk about is Ungrateful Refugee, if anybody wants to begin.
In The Ungrateful Refugee, we see Dina Nayiri's experience as a child, and one sort of quote that's from her story that strikes me is, "At first, the children were welcoming, teaching me English words, using toys and pictures, but within days, the atmosphere around me had changed. Years later, I figured this must have been how long it took for them to tell their parents about the Iranian kid." So I think this is pretty much a good discussion almost on human morality, maybe, as well as about the immigrant experience, because as she mentions, we see like these an opening and welcoming atmosphere at first from children, and it's only other people's biases, their parents' biases, that seem to come in and ruin this perception of immigrants for them.
Mm-hmm. I agree, Charlotte. I think that it's sort of like children will have their own ideas of what they believe, what they think is going on, but then once someone older than them sort of has a different opinion or tells them what that adult thinks, the kid is very impressionable and will either change their opinion or sort of look at things from a different perspective, maybe without fully understanding what that is.
Yeah, I totally agree. Like, kids are just so impressionable, and they're just like little sponges. And when they see somebody who's different from them, they don't always immediately think that that's a negative thing or a bad thing. So they just want to know more about them. But then when they go back home and there are parents who may have these biases, like, that's where they get their information from. And that's where, like, racism and stereotypes can come into play.
Yeah, Emily, that's a really good point. And there's, to move on to the next quote even, which I think really adds to that, is, I remember being confused, not at their cruelty, but at their choice of insult. A dash of racism I had expected, but I wasn't Chinese. Were these children wholly ignorant to the shape of the world outside of America? So it's kind of like there's, initially there's innocence, but there's also ignorance. And even though their children's sort of innocence is ruined by, you know, inflections of racism, their ignorance still remains the same. Like, even though they're being taught racism, they aren't even being taught, like, accurate world geography. They aren't being taught useful skills. They're remaining in the dark and remaining ignorant over this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that that's a great connection back to Jaime's interview where the kids, he talks about the kids when he was in school teasing him for being Mexican when he's from El Salvador.
Kids teasing and everything. They know I was from El Salvador, but they just decided to tease me and be like, oh, no, you're from Mexico. No, it's just Mexican. Like, a lot of it you see is centralized just towards Mexico because that's where most of the knowledge is from. And I always remember getting mad whenever they made jokes like that and then playing. And sometimes, I guess I sometimes would see people think that's actual knowledge. But then as I got older, I just got into the mindset that either some people really don't know about a lot of the world countries or everything like that, or that just some people really decide to take more of an ignorant route and not want to learn about it. So I just give up. I gave up really on trying to educate them if it seemed more towards the ignorant route.
It's like they don't even know, like, where exactly you're from, but they'll still tease you based on how you look.
Speaking of Jaime's interview, I think this next quote, it refers to Diana Nayiri's mother learning English. If she took too long to articulate a thought, they stopped and listened and wrote her off as unintelligent. They sped up their speech, and when she asked them to slow down, they sighed and rolled their eyes. That kind of reminded me of how when Jaime was talking about how he's translating for his parents, you know, obviously he mentions he had a huge sense of responsibility.
There's times where, you know, I would come to school late because I had to help out with appointments, whether that be medical, legal, even work stuff. And it was very confusing also when I was a kid because I didn't understand everything that was going on. So it was really weird when, you know, I'm reading these big words in English and then I'm like, I have no idea how to translate into Spanish. And then moments where, like, if I was at the bank and there's a problem going on, my dad is, like, angry and he looks at me. He was like, okay, I need you to say this with, like, anger in your voice. And I'm over here like, hey, my dad says that he doesn't like what you guys are doing. And if I'm not if I didn't translate fast enough or accurately enough, then my family would get mad. So it was kind of tough. It became the norm for me.
And while he didn't say it explicitly, I got the feeling that part of that sense of responsibility is, if I don't do this for my parents are going to struggle and they are going to be seen as lesser. So he's doing this to help them for their sake, rather than just, like, doing it because he wants to and doing it because it's something he can do.
Right. I remember he had mentioned also saying that being a translator at times could also be difficult for him. Just because he knew English better than his parents doesn't mean that he was the perfect translator. So being someone so young, having so much responsibility to translate either big words, if it's for an official document for something or something for the school, things could be very hard for that. And sort of, you know, I'm translating it, but what does it mean? And am I doing it right? Sort of feeling about it.
Yeah, I feel like, just going off of your point, Elena, we hold immigrants to a higher standard than I think we hold people that are immigrants, that they have to have, like Dina's quote, if she took too long to articulate a thought, they stopped listening and wrote her off as unintelligent. But if someone that wasn't an immigrant did the same thing, we would give them grace and more like time to process it. But if it's an immigrant, no, you have to be, again, this like grateful person, and you have to be perfect all the time. But yeah.
I don't know why, but for some reason, like, Gloria from Modern Family just comes into my mind when thinking of this, because there's that one scene where, like, she's getting teased by her family for her accent, and she, like, finally has sort of a breakdown, and she's like, you don't understand how smart I am in my own language. And I think that really beautifully illustrates, like, how there is that loss of, I don't know how to put it, just loss of connection between like words and knowledge, just because there are two different languages at play.
Yeah, that's like a really good point, because like to the story, Diana Nayiri's mother was a doctor, and so she's an amazingly smart woman if you're a doctor, but it's the language barrier. It's learning new medical terms in a new language. It's learning the correct way to place them in a new language that is just stopping her from, you know, doing her job, but she's capable of doing it. And so to place this burden on her and say, oh, you're not smart, you can't do your job just because there's a language barrier, is so brutal. And to Jaime, he was, you know, a child when he started translating. So, you know, he's learning, he's growing, he's not as smart as the adults around him because he's a child, but he still has this expectation that he has to be smarter than the people around him to translate for them and for his parents.
Yeah, definitely agreed. Something I thought about when you were saying that, Charlotte, was, this is a little bit off topic, but in Grey's Anatomy and a lot of different shows where they have someone that is a dominant character that is part of a marginalized community, like Maggie Pierce is a Black woman that's a cardiothoracic surgeon, and if like she takes notice and she says this about a particular problem, she's like being more dominant and everything, but people will talk about the man that's in charge. And I just thought about that, how like, again, you were saying about Dina's mom being a surgeon, and just because she speaks a different language than what people want to perceive her, they don't treat her as like the smart person that she is, obviously, because like you have to be really smart to be a surgeon. Any more comments, I guess, on that before we go to the next piece? Okay, cool. So the next piece we'll talk about is translation as an arithmetic loss. Okay, so the first quote that we have is, when you live between languages, the conversion of meaning is an arithmetic and loss. The transference of what I want to say pours from one container into an incompatible receptacle. Inevitably, something is lost. I'm used to thinking of something in Spanish, for example, which then comes out strangely in English or cannot be said in English at all. Not in the same way. I'm used to being understood sufficiently rather than fully. I guess, Charlotte, if you wanted to say something about that one.
Yeah, thank you, Hannah. So what really strikes me about this quote is, I mean, we were just talking about this idea of being, you having to be smart, quote unquote, to be able to translate between languages and be, you know, a successful translator. You have to be greater than everybody else. But it's really like demonstrating that you're put at such a disadvantage when you're translating between languages, because there is not an easy way to express concepts and ideas necessarily between languages. And no matter, like, even if you're saying the most simple thing, the way you say it in each language drastically changes, which then changes kind of the tone that comes across, which then changes the meaning and how it's expressed to you. So it feels like it's I mean, I really love the comparison that it's a transference between incompatible containers, like pouring a liquid and things are just spilling out because the containers are not made for each other.
Yeah, that also got me thinking about in Jaime's interview where he talks about having to translate for his dad as a kid. And he says, like, if he would have to go to like an appointment or like to the bank with his dad, and his dad is upset and is trying to convey that, like, he doesn't know how to navigate, like, does he also convey that emotion, or how does he translate like that emotion but also like the correct words into English? So it's like, it's hard to find that balance finding how do you convey the emotion correctly but also like in the correct like equivalent in both languages.
I agree. I definitely think that with translation, you get the idea across where this is what's being said, but how much are you actually stating with what you're saying? Like, I can't remember, I think it was this article, the translation at an arithmetic loss. It said, like, I'm losing my thought. It'll come back to me. Give me a moment.
Okay. That comes back to you. I'll go with the short quote. More than half my life has been lived in translation, which I think we've just been talking about Jaime having to translate for his parents as a child to his, you know, presumably adulthood until the point he moved out. But so you're having to live your life not only obviously translating for yourself in your head and translating for other people, but when you do that, essentially you're like taking time away from actually living your life. You don't get to just think and move on. You have to think, move, and then translate, and then get that response, and then translate back, and then move on. So it's like, it's almost like the idea that everybody has 24 hours in a day, but some people have to spend it differently. But people are constantly having to translate for, you know, their family members or for themselves. They have much less time in their 24-hour day because they're spending so much time thinking.
I remembered my thought. I remembered it. it was about puns, how puns are very specific to their own language. You can't translate a pun because it's not going to make sense in whatever other language you're saying it in. Like, it's the same thing with translation. Something makes sense in one language. However, can you fully actually express what's being said when you're trying to express it in another language? And like, how difficult is that representation of language?
That is the perfect example. Thank you. That's like, I don't know, it's just gonna stick in my head for like the rest of time, I feel like. Moving on to the next quote. I believe this is the quote. So even though the interpreter spoke with speed and diligence to Madi, telling her that what was being said, it didn't matter. As my mother tried to engage with an unfamiliar system of medicine in a language she couldn't understand, I became acutely aware of translation failures. Just loosely talking back about what Elena said, I feel like this also kind of talks and ties back to it about like translation failures. Like a random connection, even like with Netflix translations or basic like TV translations, anytime they translate from one language to another, or like even Google Translate, it's not going to be absolutely perfect. So you will lose like the authenticity of the original sentence or paragraph. That's the first thing I thought about.
There's also, I think as interesting as this quote points out, the different kinds of translations, because obviously we've been talking about kind of more emotional translations, I think, or funny translations with puns, but things that make you, feel. And I would say that's completely different from what's going on here. Like we're talking about, in this case, medicinal translations, where now you're not only dealing with a foreign language, but you're dealing with an entirely new concept, which I think most people don't really understand medicine that well, unless you're a nurse practitioner or a doctor. But so you're having to kind of like, you're doubling up on the amount of intensity it takes to understand what's going on, the amount of work that's going into it. It's kind of like a new, because medicine itself is almost like it's a new language. So it's like a double translation.
Yeah, my thoughts exactly. Like, took the words right out of my mouth, Charlotte.
So our last
literary piece for today was talking about the community support. One of the bigger things that we wanted to highlight in this discussion was access to legal representation for those in immigration proceedings. Is really critical to fairness and due process. And from this website, it says it increases the likelihood both of participating in court hearings and obtaining immigration relief. About 61% of responding organizations provide long-term immigration legal services, such as representation throughout a person's immigration case. 46% reported providing full representation in immigration cases, and just over half, or 51%, of respondents provide referrals to other legal service providers, but with ongoing supervision or other support. So going off of that, I guess, what were y'all's thoughts just like reading those like mind-blowing statistics?
Well, those numbers sound pretty good, but then if you consider that, like the inversion of them, that means, so 61% of organizations provide long-term legal support. So I think that means 39% don't, and that 49% of respondents provide referral or don't respond or provide referrals to other legal groups, and that 44% don't provide full representation. So that's like, if you invert those statistics, that's like still like almost half in each case are not getting proper legal access, which is pretty devastating.
Yeah, I was a little surprised by the numbers. I thought that they would have been lower, actually. Like, it's still upsetting that they are as low as they are, just based off what Charlotte just shared, but I really thought that it was going to be way lower. So it's like a nice surprise that they're not as low as I thought that they would be, but it's still upsetting that there is so much room for improvement.
I'm reminded of, I believe it was back in 2016 or 2017 when they began doing like the mass ICE raids or the deportations and all of that, how there were children that had to go up and testify for themselves or try and explain what's going on. Literal 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds. It's like, and without any representation at all. And the fact that either young kids have to experience this from extremely young ages to adults having to experience this, it's not right how these numbers are and how little help these people are actually receiving.
Yeah, that's like a great point, Elena, because with our last statistics, that goes to show that, you know, who's funding these organizations that are providing legal support? Well, so 84% are individual donations, 72% of that is just philanthropy, and 60% is faith-based, of that 84%. And only 42% of respondents had received support from the federal government and 38% from the state government. So those children speaking up there, when the people who are their lawyers who are speaking there on behalf of them, those lawyers are provided not by the government, but by charitable people or by religious associations.
So thanks guys for everything. Those last few statistics, Charlotte, I feel were something I guess I didn't think about, like 84% being individual donations and 72% philanthropy, with the smallest statistics being from federal, state, and local government funding is shocking. So thank you all again for that great discussion. It was super refreshing to hear what other people thought about these pieces of literature and how they connected to our narrator. Hi, Mae's interview. Thanks, guys.
And now, here are some clips from our interview with Jaime that connect to our literary discussion. Jaime's family journey to the United States.
Yeah, so I was born in El Salvador. My parents were born in El Salvador. When I was 3 years old, we moved down here. And the way that they did it personally was they got a tourist visa. so that they could see Charlottesville specifically. And then within the time frame of, well, after the expiration of the visa, we just decided to stay here. And then we applied for something called temporary protected status, which I believe during that time there was a huge earthquake going on around in El Salvador. So it was essentially sort of a like a refugee asylum type status.
Having to act as a translator as a child.
So for my parents, I know for sure that the language barrier is the tough parts. Because my dad and my mom over there, they were in college, they were doing college. And then, you know, I was born, so they sort of dropped out to do that. But when they came over here, they've had a harder time trying to communicate with people, especially when they first got here. So once I got to a certain age, I essentially was, you know, interpreter. I had to help help with everything, going to doctor's visit, going paperwork, all that stuff. There's times where, you know, I would come to school late because I had to help out with certain, with appointments, whether that be medical, legal, even work stuff. And it was very confusing also when I was a kid because I didn't understand everything that was going on. So it was really weird when, you know, I'm reading these big words in English and then I'm like, I have no idea how to translate into Spanish. And then moments where, like, if I was at the bank and there's a problem going on, my dad is, like, angry, and he looks at me, he was like, okay, I need you to say this with, like, anger in your voice. And I'm over here like, hey, my dad says that he doesn't like what you guys are doing. And if I'm not, if I didn't translate fast enough or accurately enough, then my family would get mad. So it was kind of tough. It became the norm for me. And then even to this day, still happens. I'll be at work, my parents call me, I have to figure something out. So it was a little stressful as a kid, for sure.
Jaime's community.
With my family, with my parents in specific right now, since I moved out, it's been a little bit tougher because I have less time to see them. But usually I go over, or me and my wife will go over, I cook for them, hang out with them for a little bit. If they have anything they want to do, we definitely do that. Like, I know today we're going to the circus because apparently my parents really wanted to do that. With my friends, one of the more unique things that we do is D&D, Dungeons and Dragons, as a like a clique. But then I do individual things with individual friends. One of my friends, Tyler, I've been friends with him since senior year of high school. Randomly, we'll just hang out, get some food, go look at cards for a game called Yu-Gi-Oh! Or Pokemon. We'll get more dice, get ice cream, run any errands that we have to do. So it's a lot of, it's not as much interacting with a whole friend group as much as I interact individually with all my friends.
The financial aid application process and its barriers.
And then the biggest thing after high school, I would say, was realizing that since the immigration status I had was unique, sort of, I didn't have access to things financially, so like financial aid federally. So when it came to doing community college, I had to pay for all the classes by myself. My parents helped a little bit, but I was working, so I would pay for all the classes by myself, pay for all the books and everything that I needed for myself. And then after that, going into University of Mary Washington, I wasn't able to take out any student loans. So I fortunately had this one really close family friend of mine. When I moved into the neighborhood I moved in now, one of my friends there, her name's Rachel, and her parents and I got close as we got older and everything. I started going over more, hanging out with them, doing dinners and everything like that. And I remember it was crazy to me just being used to being independent. I always think I have to have like a whole PowerPoint in my head if I have to ask people questions. So I remember when I was filling out applications for a private student loan, it said that I needed a cosigner because I wasn't, I didn't have a green card, I wasn't a permanent resident or anything like that. And I go over to my friend Rachel's parents, she wasn't there, and I go in and I'm just like, all right, I had numbers in my head, percentages, like how much I had to pay back a month, all this and that, ready to like just give them all the information. I go up to her dad and I'm like, hey, I have a question. And he's like, what's up? And I was like, would you mind being a co-signer? And then without hesitating, no like question asked, he was like, yeah, just send me over the application forms that I need to fill out and I'll do it. And I'm just like, what do you mean? Are you just that confident in me? Like, are you that confident in me that you think I'll be fine being a co-signer? Like, you do know that there are repercussions if like something bad happens. And he had full faith in me. So I was like, whoa, okay, well, dang. And I think as I got older, I realized that the friendships I made were a little bit deeper than I thought. So I knew I was close with all my friends. And then I realized how close I was and how much faith and how like deep they, or how highly they did think of me or think of me, when it came to the green card process that we went through last year. And one of the things that helped the process is having letters from friends and family, you know, talking about the relationship and everything like that. And I just threw it out there because I was like, you know, if they're busy, I get it. But every time I asked one of my friends, they just super quick said, yeah. And then within a couple of days, they had something for me. And when I read the letters, they were super positive. I could see that they definitely, you know, noticed the love in the relationship, but I could also see the love that they had for us individually and as a couple. And then again, same thing with my friend Rachel's dad. One of the things that we had to do, since we are young, we didn't have a lot of income going on, especially because they had to look at the taxes from the year prior, and we were both still in school, me and Emily. And it again asked for a co-sponsor, someone who essentially would take responsibility if I were to, you know, dip out and leave all my debts and everything to one person. And so this one had a lot more writing on it, and I texted Chuck again, and I was like, hey, would you mind being a co-sponsor? Like, we can't do it by ourselves. We didn't earn enough. They want someone who does earn enough to essentially vouch for us. And I almost cried when he said it, because it wasn't just like a yeah. He was just like, yeah, it would be my honor to help out with something like that. And I remember reading it, and I was about to be in tears because I was like, oh, wow, that's crazy. The toughest part, again, was the not having financial aid. That was the first time I realized that I didn't have access to that. But since it was community college, it wasn't too bad. I didn't have bills. I didn't have rent or anything like that. So a lot of the money that I would save up through the summer and after I would pay for a semester would be enough to pay for the next semester when it came around. And then I made more friends there, so the classes weren't too bad. They were a little difficult, but that was mostly because I wasn't the best student. I didn't learn good studying habits or anything like that. But I made friend group who were in the same classes, people I could rely on, text, figure things out. The most confusing part for me was when it came to applying towards Mary Washington. The application part wasn't too bad. It's the same thing as everything else. That part I was used to doing applications because I was always helping my parents do applications. Under the temporary protected status, we have to renew that essentially almost every year and a half. So since I was probably 8, I would always have to read the applications, fill it out for my parents, just make sure I got all the information right. So when it comes to forms, that part isn't too tough for me. The confusing part was afterwards, because I didn't know that I had to put a deposit down to actually get down any of the information I needed. I didn't know what stuff I had to pack towards going to school. I didn't know who to contact when it came to classes. Again, it was essentially the whole independent thing. I had to figure out who to contact, how to contact them, where to send the money and everything. And luckily, having to be independent from a young age, I was able to figure that out pretty quickly. And a lot of the resources that colleges give helps towards that. Then it came towards the taking out the student loan. That part was a big bummer, knowing that, you know, since I didn't have financial aid, that I was going to have to take out this large sum of money to actually pay for my college. But then aside from that, the college experience was pretty good. I met new friends. I struggled a little bit, but I found ways to overcome my bad studying habit. I saw that if I actually applied myself, I had teachers who were willing to vouch for me when it came to certain things.
Experiences with racism as a child.
Luckily, we moved to a, you know, town that was pretty diverse. There was already a lot of Hispanics in that area. And I don't know if it was, you know, by fortune of where we moved or just my luck personally with people, with meeting people and, you know, who I hung out with. I rarely ever had to face, you know, any racism. I never really had to face any bias towards the fact that I was an immigrant. For me, it was anything that was anything that was focused on immigration was mostly in the family, trying to figure out what we can do or figure out how to do certain things. I did learn when I was younger that I would get mad whenever people would not overlook, but, you know, kids teasing and everything. They know I was from El Salvador, but they just decided to tease me and be like, oh, no, you're from Mexico. No, it's just Mexican. Like, a lot of it you see is centralized just towards Mexico because that's where most of the knowledge is from. And I always remember getting mad whenever they made jokes like that and then playing. And sometimes, I guess I sometimes would see people think that's actual knowledge. But then as I got older, I just got into the mindset that either some people really don't know about a lot of the world countries or everything like that, or that just some people really decide to take more of an ignorant route and not want to learn about it. So I gave up really on trying to educate them if it seemed more towards the ignorant route.
And lastly, psychology as his major / graduating college as a huge accomplishment and plans for future.
The psychology really hasn't affected much. The degree itself, it has been a little helpful, especially when taking the class, to be a little bit more insightful on how I grew up and everything like that and how the mind works. I did take a mindfulness class, and when I took that class, that one really definitely helped more from the perspective of my parents, because even though I grew up with them, I did grow up in America, so I saw two different cultures. And since most of my friends were Americans and most of my friends were like born and raised here, it was easier to see it from their point of view. But once I took the mindfulness class, I was like, all right, cool. Like, my parents did live a whole different lifestyle before getting here, so the way they express themselves is completely different. Honestly, just getting my college degree. I think that was one thing. Like, my parents, especially my dad, was something that he really, really wanted me to get. And I never really had any long-term goals. I never really planned for my life or anything like that. I always just wanted to do... I always went by, like, go with the flow. So when I graduated high school, I was freaking out because I didn't really know what to do. And then when I was in PBCC, I took classes, got my associate's and just in a general associate's degree, and didn't really know. And the only reason that I did psychology was because at the moment where I decided to apply, I realized that I had took two psychology classes in my senior year of high school, and they did interest me, and not in the, like, deep sense, like, epiphany style. It was just cool. It was interesting. And I was like, all right, cool. Might as well just go with a psychology degree because that's the only thing that's going to interest me and not have me bored as I'm taking classes. And then slowly but surely, as I took more classes, I realized, like, oh, okay, well, now I'm understanding what's going on. This is something that I've been doing with my friends a lot, like helping them out. It was a lot more logical than I thought when I thought of psychology. And as I started seeing through that point, I was like, okay, cool. I actually do like psychology. And then so when I got my college degree, that was the biggest thing. I guess the next long-term goal is getting my master's degree in psychology to have more access, or to have access to more jobs and do what I really want to do.
previous episode, Mixed, tells the story of Isabella Peza, a mixed-race child of immigrants. She tells the story of both her parents' immigrations to the United States, as well as the unique family dynamic she grew up with. Isabella describes the pressure of living the American dream and being a successful immigrant. We see a similar narrative through Jaime's life, with the pressure of being a good immigrant by being a translator and a mediator for his family. We also see a similar focus on familiar support, with both Jaime and Isabella having help both tangibly and emotionally since they were young. Though both stories have common themes, it's important to note that no one immigrant story is the same.
While Jaime was able to have a strong support system from a young age, we know that this is not always the case with immigrants and children of immigrants. In the next episode, you will hear from a different point of view and experience with David Figueroa. You can find links to the full transcript in the description of the podcast below, as well as links to the literary pieces we discussed earlier. Make sure to follow us on our various social media platforms. You can find us at @Harrisonburg360 for Facebook and Instagram, and @360Harrisonburg on Twitter. Additionally, you can use the #Harrisonburg360 as a way to find us. Thank you for joining us today on Harrisonburg 360. We're super grateful to Dr. Fagan for giving us the opportunity to record this podcast and share our narrator story. Thank you to these wonderful people for helping make this episode possible. Kate Morris, Bodine Amiot, Sarah Rothmullet, and Kirsten Moidinia. Our host today was Hannah Nick. The interview with Jaime Cañas was conducted by Charlotte Lawrence Hovey. Our research and content producer was Elena Sanders, and our audio producer was Emily Kilman. Join us next time for Home.